Welcome to episode 70 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm John Hickner, family physician and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Family Practice, and I'm snowed in Michigan's Upper Peninsula this morning.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, also about to be snowed in here in Grand Rapids. I'm a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPalms. There are a couple of things that happened today in history. Probably the most important one is that this is the anniversary in 1994 of the person who assassinated Medgar Evers was finally found guilty more than 30 years after the crime was committed. Medgar Evers, if you'll recall, was an important civil rights advocate, worked for the Mississippi NAACP organizing voters registration and the like. The other thing that happened today in history was, we recently noted the passing of Hank Aaron. Well, today would have been his 87th birthday. So both Medgar Evers and Hank Aaron, both from different perspectives, were important in terms of advocating for civil rights for African Americans and others.
And I read some, detailed obituaries on Hank Aaron, and it's amazing. You think of him with the home run record, but then all of the other records that he had, some of which will never be touched, like the slugging totals and things like that. Anyway, I'm sure all of our listeners are as big baseball fans as you and I, Henry.
That's right.
So we'll move on. So on this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or POEMS. If you want all the POEMS, subscribe to Essential Evidence. You'll get one every day in your email, plus a great primary care reference with over 800 topics and thousands of interactive decision support tools. You can find it at essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. You can get CME credit that is free from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians for listening to this podcast. Just go to iafp.mclms.net to claim it. This week, we're going to discuss a new use for an old-timey drug, pregnancy after contraception, and prostate cancer screening. And the first poem is mine, and the title is Colchicine Reduces MI and Revascularization in Patients with Established Coronary Disease. This was in the New England Journal. The author was Nydorf, and it's the LODOCO2 trial investigator, so low-dose colchicine, I guess. And so these researchers recruited patients that had documented coronary disease on either CT or invasive angio, or who had a very high coronary artery calcium score. They excluded anyone with renal disease, severe valve disease, or heart failure. And they started with an open label run-in period that ended up excluding about 15% of patients, mainly because they didn't tolerate the colchicine. So those patients never made it into the study. They make it into your practice. So the results you see in practice in terms of tolerability are probably going to be worse. The remaining 5,500 were randomized to colchicine, 0.5 milligrams once daily or placebo. They were followed for a median of just over 2 years, 29 months, and there was no difference between groups in withdrawals or side effects. So once you got rid of those 15% who didn't tolerate it initially, it was pretty well tolerated by the remainder. They looked at four different composite outcomes. You know how we feel about composite outcomes. The primary composite was cardiovascular death, MI, stroke, so far so good, or revascularization due to ischemia. You know, so that's throwing in that revascularization, bit of a apples and oranges. That primary outcome was reduced with colchicine by about absolute 2.8%. Number needed to treat was 36 over 29 months to prevent one of those events. And if you drop the revascularization, which I would do, this was an open label trial. It's quite different in, I would say, magnitude from the other outcomes. That was still improved, 4.2 versus 5.7%. The NNT there is a little higher, about 67, to prevent one death, MI, or stroke over just over 2 years. If you look at individual endpoints, it was mainly driven by MI and revascularization that were significantly reduced with colchicine. There was no statistically significant difference in the individual outcomes of stroke, cardiovascular, or all-cause mortality. There were trends toward fewer cardiovascular deaths, but there was also a trend toward more non-cardiovascular deaths. The hazard ratio there was 1.5. the confidence interval 0.9 to 2.3. So it was almost a significant increase in non-cardiovascular deaths. Myalgias were also a bit more common in the colchicine group. Bottom line, colchicine 0.5 milligram daily significantly reduces the risk of MI and revascularization in patients with known heart disease. For the composite of cardiovascular death, MI or ischemic stroke, the NNT was 67 over 29 months. It's relatively cheap, $8 a month in Canada, $65 a month in the US. There was this worrisome signal in the data that was not quite statistically significant, but certainly needs further study and follow-up of increased non-cardiovascular mortality. When the authors looked at those deaths, they didn't see any clear pattern in terms of was it cancer, was it respiratory, or what exactly. They were just sort of a scattered causes of death. John, any comments on this one?
Mark, I'm presuming that these patients were otherwise managed well medically, so they were on statins, aspirin, et cetera. If these people were managed well otherwise, this NNT is pretty similar to that we see with use of statins. And the fact that this is an inexpensive drug makes this potentially a promising therapy. Probably we need a little more experience, though, because of the signal that there may be other harmful effects, especially the non-cardiovascular deaths. But we'll wait and see. I don't know if this will be adopted in a widespread way or not.
Yeah, the thinking is that it's an anti-inflammatory, of course, that's colchicine, and that may be its, you know, the mechanism. And there was another study in patients with a recent acute MI that also showed benefit. So they're trying to basically work their way down the food chain in terms of intensity from fresh MI, acute coronary syndrome. Now it's stable coronary disease. And, you know, I do think we need probably another study to see if they can verify and find the same findings. Henry?
So I have a snarky comment, and maybe that's the thing that you were just alluding to, is that this is the Lodoco 2, whatever happened to Lodoco 1. Maybe that was the group that had recent acute coronary syndromes. Just stepping back a little bit as to who they included, having abnormal calcium scores and calcifications on CT does not necessarily mean that these are patients with occlusive disease. And so I wonder if those who had invasive testing were more symptomatic, and if that's the risk group that drove most of these findings.
They're pre-occlusive disease, Henry. That's what we call pre-occlusive.
Yeah, right. and so again, looking at the severity spectrum, is this really a function of disease severity? And then I'd just like to comment, we alluded to this a little bit in one of our talks a while back. And in this study, there was no difference in all-cause mortality. So we have a fixed pie. And so if you increase the slice of one pie in terms of the cardiovascular death, you're going to have a smaller slice for other kinds of things. So this may just be purely a statistical phenomenon and not anything that really is robust.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I think it's promising. I think it's great to see an older drug that may have potential, and we'll see. Henry, the quiz.
So Valentine's Day takes place next week, and this is a day that puts a great deal of emphasis on romance and sex. While a lot of attention in the lay literature, media, and research focuses on male sexual dysfunction, the quiz this month focuses on female sexual dysfunction. Which of the following statements are true? 1. Men are much more likely to experience sexual dysfunction. 2. Laboratory testing always uncovers the cause. 3. Drugs are unlikely to enhance sexual desire in most women. 4. Couples therapy is not effective. Stay tuned.
Thanks, Henry. Time for your poem. We're going to learn about how long it takes to conceive after different kinds of contraception are stopped.
This is a paper by Yaland, Yland, and colleagues, published in the BMJ. And they recruited almost 18,000 women in Denmark and the U.S. These are women who had stopped using contraceptives within the previous 6 months and who were trying to become pregnant. So it's a specific group of individuals. Just over a third of the women were taking oral contraceptives. About another third were using barrier methods. And the rest were using natural methods and long-acting reversible methods. They followed the women for about 12 months. And during that time, 56% of the women conceived within the first 6 months, and just over three quarters conceived within the year afterwards. The use of the injectable contraceptives had the lowest rate of pregnancy than the others. And the other thing that they found was that the women who were using a hormonal intrauterine device had about a 20% higher rate of pregnancy than those who were using barrier devices or copper devices. And when they looked at the data a little bit further, the duration of using hormonal contraceptives did not seem to have any association with fecundity, which is a great word. So on average, more than half of women who stop using contraception and try to become pregnant will do so within 6 months, and over three quarters will become pregnant within a year. And these data are comparable to data about oral contraceptives, the old-timey oral contraceptives from a study I recall reading way back during residency days.
Great study, Henry. It's just very useful, practical information that we can share with our patients, because that's a question that women have. How long, what can I expect? How long should I wait? And then particularly having data on some of these newer contraceptive options, I think that's, really helpful to have. And, don't worry if you're using an injectable contraceptive, but you haven't gotten pregnant in the first half a year, be patient. So anyway, good information. John?
Henry, I have a question that's not in the abstract here. How did the natural method compare to the hormonal methods? In other words, do the hormonal methods have less pregnancy, a lower pregnancy rate at 12 months compared to just using a natural method? Or does it rebound and at 12 months it's about the same?
I'll have to get back to you on that.
Thank you. Maybe you could present that at our next podcast then.
All right.
So, John, you're going to tell us a little more about prostate cancer screening when I thought we knew everything there was to know about it.
I thought so, too. The title of this poem is, Can Prostate-Specific Antigen-Based Risk Stratified Screening Decrease the Screening Burden Without Increasing Harms to Men? This is really a fascinating study, and it may portend the way that we will go eventually with prostate cancer screening, which has not died. It is still out there. This is a study that was published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute last year. Screening for prostate cancer has been controversial, as we all know, but most of the controversy really is related to balancing the potential benefits against the harms of screening. One possible way to decrease the harm and maintain most of the benefit is to screen less frequently, just as we've done with cervical cancer screening. The rationale behind less frequent screening is that there will be fewer direct harms of pursuing the false positive results, and there will be less overdiagnosis. But, however, at the potential risk of more cancers missed and more cancer deaths. So these researchers used two independently different computer simulations to model and evaluate the trade-offs of less frequent than yearly screening, starting at either age 45 or 50. The authors compared their model performance with real-world data from the Malmo Prevention Project, which is good. And when they compared the data and the outcomes, it really looked very similar. This was to say that this model was not just made up. It was based on real world data. So they started with virtual men at age 45 or 50 years of age, and then followed them up in the model up to 85 years. The models now, there were two models again, they evaluated several different strategies. So this gets a little bit confusing. The baseline model was screening every 2 years until age 69. Okay, so that's kind of the baseline. And then the variations included lengthening the screening interval to 8 years if the baseline PSA was less than 1.0. But if it arose again to above 1.0, they go back to every 2 years. The other variation was to stop screening when the PSA is less than 1 at age 60 years or older, or a combination of these two ways of screening. Now, if the PSA level exceeded 4.0, just as traditionally, that would trigger further investigation such as biopsy. Okay, so here's the results. If you screen 10,000 men every 2 years as the baseline model, between ages 45 and 69, that would require about 100,000 screenings, so lots of them. One of the two computer models would have yielded 277 overdiagnoses. The other would yield 348 overdiagnoses, so pretty similar in terms of overdiagnosis, which of course means diagnosing cancers that are not going to harm a person. Additionally, they would have saved 110 to 160 lives and gained 928 and 1,312 life years relative to no screening. So obviously, this shows some significant advantage in the screening. If you use the risk-based screening, that is, if you stop screening if the PSA is less than 1 and the patient is 60 years or older, and if you lengthen the interval to 8 years if the PSA is less than 1 prior to age 60, the models predict that the number of screenings would be cut nearly in half compared to screening every 2 years. And the overdiagnosis of inconsequential prostate cancer would be reduced by 2.1 to 1% respectively, depending upon the model that you used. Now, this is the real surprise. The models also showed a small reduction in life saved, but if you stop screening, if the PSA was less than 1 at age 60 or older, you decrease the relative risk of overdiagnosis by 24% and 5% respectively. And in the end, that actually saved more lives. In one model, you save 13.1% more lives by reducing the screening based on risk. So again, this is a little bit complicated, but the bottom line is that both of these models suggest that if you use a risk-based strategy, that is, if the PSA is less than 1 and the patient is 60 or over, you just stop screening, or if the PSA is reduced to testing every 8 years, if the PSA is 1 or less at less than age 60, it really gives you fewer screenings, fewer overdiagnoses, and actually more lives saved. So this is very intriguing. And although I've thrown out a lot of numbers and it's a little bit confusing, I think the bottom line is that a strategy, just like cervical cancer screening, of less frequent screening based on risk may be the way to go in the future. Now, I haven't seen any official recommendations that look like this. And Mark, I don't know if you're still in touch with USPSTF, and if they have mulled over this idea of less frequent screening and risk-based screening.
Yeah, when I was on the task force and we were voting on prostate cancer screening, the modelers did not give us these options. And we did talk about it, but it's certainly something that has been discussed in other publications. I think there are so many interesting things here. You know, one is that they assumed the baseline was every other year. And you know, there's no reason to think that once a year is always the best interval for doing anything, right? That's just how far we are from the sun. And so in Europe and in many other countries, every other year is the standard. The American Cancer Society says if your PSA is less than 2.5, every other year is fine. So even they are kind of on board, and they tend to be fairly aggressive around prostate cancer screening. It is, you know, quite a trade-off. You have, looks like, 3 overdiagnosed cancers per life extended for 10 years. So one person gets their life extended 10 years, 3 people have to deal with the consequences of treatment for prostate cancer. So, you know, that's reasonable. People could say, is that worth it? Yes, it is. No, it isn't. You know, it's certainly in a gray area for me in terms of whether that's of value. And I think maybe some of that reduce the saving more lives by doing less has to do with fewer complications of biopsies, episodes of sepsis, surgical complications, you know, all of those other knock-on kind of consequences of the screening process. So there's a ton here, but I think we're headed in the right direction, that if we do choose after shared decision-making with our patients to do this, that here are some options that we're learning about, that we have more to learn about, that that could mitigate some of those harms potentially. Henry, I've talked a lot, but I'm sure you have more to add.
That's okay. So we're going to see a lot more of these modeling studies, and in large part because big real-world studies like this are too complex to pull off, they're too expensive, or you're subject to entrenched practice patterns that Mark's alluded to already. So, for example, in the prostate, lung cancer, ovarian prevention trial, screening trial, one of the PLCO limitations was the frequency of PSA testing in the control group that may have contaminated some of the results. So these are a mechanism by which we can try to obviate those limitations. The second reason for talking about this is that, as we're going to hear about more models, there are two main ways that we should be looking at them. One has to do with the structure of the model itself, and the other has to do with the underlying assumption. So when we think about the structure, it might be the sequence of events. It should look like they've incorporated all of the logical outcomes. And in this case, we've already identified that not only did they not include complications of screening other than overdiagnosis, they also didn't include important things like quality of life. And in terms of the underlying assumptions, this really relates to the data, their precision, their certainty. And this is one of those areas where the modelers, in order to try to overcome the limitations of the data, ought to do a lot of sensitivity analyses where they vary the data to see how robust are their findings. And John, I don't recall seeing any sensitivity analyses in this paper.
No, I didn't see any either. That I'm glad you brought that up. That was one concern of mine too.
And I think one other thing to this is probably optimistic in terms on the benefit side, because the Melmo data, you know, there were a bunch of prostate cancer screening trials, the PLCO you mentioned, but then there was a European set of trials from multiple different countries. And some countries found no benefit. The two countries that found the most benefit were Sweden and the Netherlands. And Sweden in particular found the most benefit of prostate cancer screening. So if anything, it's kind of baking in by using the Malmo data, it's kind of baking in a more optimistic set of assumptions. So yeah, there's a lot here. And I think, you know, we really have to, you know, the models can be very helpful, but they can also be misleading. And, you know, as you've correctly pointed out, the underlying assumptions and which outcomes they value and measure are all super important. So anyway, good stuff. We're going to find out the answer to the quiz.
So the quiz asked the question, which of the following statements about sexual dysfunction in women is true? One, men are much more likely to experience sexual dysfunction. Two, laboratory testing always uncovers the truth, the cause. Three, drugs are unlikely to enhance sexual desire in most women. Four, couples therapy is not effective. So to answer this question, I went to another shameless plug for Essential Evidence Plus, and there's a chapter on female sexual dysfunction. And it goes through a lot of really good information, and I've synthesized some of this. So first of all, studies have shown pretty variable frequency of sexual desire disorders, ranging from about 31% to almost half in women and anywhere from 1 to 38% in men. Most of those studies, however, survey patients who are seeking care for a variety of reasons and might skew the data one way or another. But in a population-based study of just over 1,700 women, about 40% had some form of sexual dysfunction. A quarter had low desire. Another 14% had problems with arousal. And 7% experienced sexual pain. So a lot more prevalent than we thought. The consensus is that clinicians should begin by taking a detailed history, including the onset and duration of the dysfunction, and determine the circumstances around it. Does it occur with a specific partner, in a certain setting, or a definable circumstance? And they also recommend that we should ask the woman what they believe is causing the problem, as well as their expectations of treatment. The recommendation also is that each patient should undergo a gynecologic examination, but you ought to be tailored to the woman based on her comfort and the like. And the reason for doing this is it also gives you an opportunity to educate the woman about normal anatomy and sexual function, as well as to reproduce and localize pain that they might encounter during sexual activity. Lab testing should be guided based on the patient's symptoms and examination, and no specific tests are universally recommended for women with sexual dysfunction. In terms of treatment, there are two FDA-approved drugs that I know of, flibanserin, or ADDI, and I'm going to butcher this one, bromelanotide, or Vyleesi. And in various randomized trials, mostly used to justify the FDA approval, each was found to induce statistically significant changes in some scale measures of sexual function, but the clinical significance is highly questionable. And the downside of flibanserin was one of the major criticisms of the FDA approval. Couples therapy with a licensed marriage and family therapist with a specialization in sex therapy is the preferred approach, but there are a lot of barriers: cost, availability, and embarrassment. Now, if you're going to embark on a discussion with women, there's a model that they describe called the Plicit model. This helps to facilitate getting care. So first is to gain permission to discuss sexual problems. Give limited information to the patient about normal sexual response cycle, and then to make specific suggestions that are directly related to their complaint. And then they recommend intensive therapy with a sexual health specialist or marriage and family therapist. So the correct answer is three, that drugs are not likely to enhance sexual desire in women.
Thanks, Henry. John, take us home with a recommendation.
Sure. If you want to feel the experience of a Syrian refugee, read the novel The Beekeeper of Aleppo. Although the author, Christy Leftery, is from London, she spent time in her 20s volunteering in a refugee camp in Greece, an experience that had an enormous emotional impact on her. Her characters are fictional, but they come to life as Leftery bounces back and forth in time, starting with Nuri and Afra's wonderful life in Aleppo, followed by their treacherous trips from Syria to squalid refugee camps in Turkey and Greece, and ending with relocation in the UK. It is a tragic story that's all too common, unfortunately.
Thanks, John. This gives me a chance to give a plug-in for my colleague, Henda Zari. She's a family physician at Michigan State University, who we've mentioned earlier. For several years, she's been going to the Syrian refugee camps, mostly in Jordan, I believe, to provide healthcare. And when she goes, she takes various types of physicians and other healthcare providers and students. And I believe it was 2 years ago, she was recognized by the Syrian American Medical Society for the work that she does.
Great. Well done, Dr. Azari. Thank you for listening. The Illinois Academy of Physicians. You can get CME credit at iafp.mclms.net. They are accredited by the ACCME to provide CME for physicians. This podcast is an enduring activity with a maximum of 0.5 credits. The IFP adheres to the conflict of interest policy of the ACCME and the AMA. It's the policy of the IAFP to ensure balance, independence, objectivity, and scientific rigor in all of its educational activities. By way of disclosure, Henry and I are paid by Wiley as editorial consultants to write poems, but we're not paid to do this podcast. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Please like us on iTunes and the Apple Podcast app and wherever else you get your podcast. We'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.